The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
I sold my car on Carvana last night.
Well, that's cool.
No, you don't understand. It went perfectly. Real offer, down to the penny. They're picking it up tomorrow. Nothing went wrong.
So, what's the problem?
That is the problem. Nothing in my life goes as smoothly. I'm waiting for the catch.
Maybe there's no catch.
That's exactly what a catch would want me to think.
Wow, you need to relax.
I need to knock on wood. Do we have wood? Is this table wood?
I think it's laminate.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's close enough.
Car selling without a catch. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by John Hodge and J.C. Abbott from the cabin, bro. No, it's a cottage anywhere other than Saskatchewan, right?
No, it's a cabin out here, too. We call it a cabin. I mean, it's mega wood. It's not like it's far from civilization. It's on a residential street. There's a corner store up the block, but it looks like a cabin.
JC, the jumbo cabin.
That's pretty good. Oh my goodness.
That's good. What do you call it, Dunk? You call it a cottage?
In Ontario, yeah, it's called a cottage. Cabin kind of makes more sense though. Like it feels more cozy to me.
I agree. Cottage is like by a lake. Cabin is in the woods, if that makes sense.
Okay.
To anyone else. Yeah.
I will say, Manitoba, I think cottage and cabin are pretty interchangeable, but a lot of people simply just say we're going to the lake. Like a lot of people don't use the word for the actual structure, and that's because everywhere in Manitoba has a lake. I think we have something like 100,000 lakes here, and people just say, yeah.
100,000 lakes?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the number. It sounds made up. But on the license plate in Minnesota, it says land of 10,000 lakes. And Manitoba's like, those are rookie numbers. You got to get those up. That's nothing. I think it's 100,000 lakes. I can Google it.
We need somebody to fact check you, but don't have the CFL do it.
Don't have Genius Sports do it.
Yeah. Well, they'll get around to it eventually. It'll just take two quarters.
It'll be wrong a bunch of times before they potentially get the right answer. Fellas, I want to note that I had to do some rerouting on my travel back from the Saskatchewan Rough Riders game in Regina, and I bumped into a fan who was excited to talk about the Three Down Nation podcast. So shout out Brianna. I'm pretty sure it was her name. I was a little low on sleep and was surprised late at night that somebody, I hate saying this kind of stuff, but you know, wanted to take a photo with one of us. And she listens to the Three Down Nation podcast all the time. She was there in the airport with her friend. We were taking a WestJet flight to Calgary, and then I was going, you know, back to Ontario, obviously. But she said her and her girlfriends had planned a week at the cabin, and then that led into the game, Saskatchewan hosting Hamilton, and she was considering, it sounded like she was going to go to the Riders game when they're in Calgary because that's where she lives right now. So shout out to our female listeners and viewers out there, specifically Brianna. I really hope I got that name right. So tell me if I'm wrong.
JC's at Brianna's cabin right now. Why don't we bring her on?
Yeah. Come on in. No.
No, you're in
different
BC,
cabin.
Bro.
Different yeah, cabin.
Different province.
I think my girlfriend who is at the cabin would be very upset if I brought in another woman on for the podcast.
That's probably fair.
All right, boys, let's get to it before we go way outside the cabin walls here, okay? Today on the Three Down Nation podcast, we're discussing the Toronto Argonauts playing three extra road games in 2026.
Montreal losing yet another quarterback due to injury.
Mike O'Shea doubling down on a questionable late game decision.
Canadian quarterback Taylor Elgersma playing over a quarter in his second NFL preseason game.
The Blue Bombers bringing back a former All-CFL defensive back.
And primetime Deion Sanders wearing a Calgary Stampeders hat. But first, the Saskatchewan Roughriders dominated the Hamilton Tiger Cats in the supposed battle of the CFL's best on Saturday, trashing the visitors 29-9 at Mosaic Stadium. What did you make of the win? The Riders lead the West Division by 4 points at 8-1. What percentage chance do you give Saskatchewan to host the West Final?
First question first. To me, this was a separator win for the Rough Riders. I think it took them from a really good team to clearly a cut above the rest, dare I say, elite team in the Canadian Football League. As for their chances for hosting the West Final, I think it's well over 50% at this point, you know, probably 75%, but one of the games that's going to go a long way to determine that is their Week 12 matchup in Calgary. The Riders have to win that game by 15 points to hold the tiebreaker in season series over the Stamps. That said, fellas, on the other side of it, I don't want to make excuses for the Ticats here, but their travel schedule was very difficult the last number of weeks going into this. Like, for example, they had back-to-back games in BC, and then the next week on a shorter week in Edmonton. So I don't think that that was something as a professional football player that you point to and say it's an excuse. But the reality of this is that the travel, I think, took its toll on the Ticats. They did jump all over the Riders out the gate. It could have been 14-0. Credit the Riders for making it just 6-0. That would have changed the whole complexion of this football game. But it was a dominant win from the Riders, who are off a bye week, we should say. The Ticats were heading into a bye week, so you can, you know, discuss what kind of mindsets were rolling in there. But the Riders were fresh. And bye weeks aren't always something that can be used to your advantage. Just look at the Riders in week 6. They got whooped by the Calgary Stampeders at home off a bye week. So that was a big point of emphasis for Corey Mace. The other part of this game that stands out to me was the quarterback matchup. I think that with this win, Trevor Harris has firmly put himself in the MOP discussion, if not potentially elevated himself above Bo Levi Mitchell, because when you look at their season numbers overall now, Trevor Harris is averaging over 300 yards per game, and Harris has started two less games than Bo Levi Mitchell, and thrown 16 touchdowns to Bo Levi Mitchell's 21 touchdowns. So that race is going to be heated going down the stretch. And I got a feeling, we might talk about this in a little bit, that the Canadian kid out there on the West Coast, JC, he's not chilling in the cabin. He's probably in the film room. Nathan Rourke's going to have something to say about this MOP decision.
Yeah, you got to give the Riders credit. I mean, the Ticats came in, I thought, with a great defensive game plan early. I've heard Scott Mitchell say multiple times this year that Trevor Harris gets the ball out faster probably than any other quarterback in professional football.
Scott Milano, like, he's not just talking. Scott Mitchell doesn't really talk to the media.
My apologies. Scott Milanovich has said that multiple times. Obviously, Scott Milanovich coached Trevor Harris for 4 years way back when with the Toronto Argonauts at the start of Harris's CFL career. And I think that says a lot because he's not even talking about CFL. He's talking about all of professional football at every level. And Milanovich is a guy who has been a QB coach with multiple NFL teams. So he has NFL pedigree in addition to having CFL credit. Exactly. He's got a lot of experience as a coach down south, as well as he does in Canada. Obviously multiple Grey Cup wins as an OC, has one as a head coach, and has been a head coach in multiple cities, including technically Edmonton, though we won't get into that because he never actually coached a game there. Regardless, it was clear that the Tabbies came in saying, okay, if Trevor Harris is going to get rid of the ball extremely quickly, we're going to be all over him. And their DBs are playing up. They're playing physical. They're playing tight. Jonathan Moxie almost gets a pick right off the bat. And then obviously Destin Talbert made, who's having a great season, by the way, made a great pick as well. And you, I remember thinking, and Joel Gasson was in our group chat. He was at the game, of course, covering it as he always does. And Regina saying the Ticats are going to regret not taking advantage of these early opportunities. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, that was exactly the case, because you knew the Riders were going to wake up coming off their bye week, and wake up they did. And I'll give the Riders defense a ton of credit. They made Bo Levi Mitchell look like some type of, I mean, just a battered pinata. Like, he was mm-hmm. not able to find time in that pocket. Hamilton's offensive line has been arguably the best in the league through the first half of the season. But for the second time this season, the Riders absolutely lit them up. And Bo Levi Mitchell, I mean, the great equalizer in football, I've always felt, is physicality, right? You can have the best scheme, you can have the most talent, but if you're getting punched in the face on every single play, even the best, most well-coached team will break down. And I thought that's exactly what we saw happen with the Ticats. After taking some hits, Bo Levi Mitchell was not nearly as accurate as we usually see him. I ran the numbers, guys. These numbers are staggering, to be quite frank. Bo Levi Mitchell against Saskatchewan this season, this is two games, both losses, he's completed 59% of his passes for 537 yards, one touchdown, three picks. Against everybody else, he's completing 70% of his passes for 2,500 yards, 20 touchdowns, and two interceptions. So against the Riders, he's got a negative touchdown interception ratio. Against everybody else, he's throwing 10 tutties for every one pick. That is insane. And so a couple of things. First off, the Ticats are going to need to live in the film room if they play the Riders again this season. If that happens, it'll almost surely be in the Grey Cup. And the second thing is, if I'm someone who's got the tabbies on my schedule, I want my defense to go out for that game and do their very best Corey Mace impression, because clearly Corey Mace has the secret sauce when it comes to playing against Bo Levi Mitchell. As for the second part of this question, right now I will put the Riders at 70% to host the West Final. I'll put the Stamps at 25%, and I'll put the Bombers at 4%, and maybe the Lions at 1%. The Lions, with the way that their season series have worked out, I think are in a tough battle. But And I guess that means Edmonton 0. Sorry, Elks fans, but I don't think anybody's surprised. Despite the two wins, we'll talk about those later on, I promise. But as for that West Division, we won't, I think, have to wait that long, because as Dunk laid out, the Riders are playing against the Calgary Stampeders this week, and they've obviously got the home and home with the Bombers. If the Riders win all three of those games, that 70% for me goes up to like 95%. If they lose those three or they split, obviously it's a bit of a different story, but the Riders are the best team in the CFL right now. They've been at number one on my power rankings ballot for the last couple of weeks, and they've got an opportunity to really smash the gas pedal. And I don't want to say cruise control after the Banjo Bowl, but if they win these next three games, get to 11-1, that'll be pretty special.
From a Hamilton perspective, I don't put a tremendous amount of stock in this result. I think it's an anomaly when you look at their season overall. And as Dunk laid out, this was a battered team. This was a tired team that had been really screwed over by the schedule makers the last few weeks and was due a bye week. So I don't think that this is reflective of who the Hamilton Tiger Cats are. But with that said, full credit to the Saskatchewan Roughriders, because that defensive performance was incredible. I think they are undeniably the top team in the CFL right now. And I'm not a mathematician, but to answer the second question, I think I got to carry the one times by three, doing, you know, divide there. I think they're about 80% that they're going to host the West Final. I am that confident in the Saskatchewan Roughriders right now. And Dunk, I love that you brought up Trevor Harris, because I think he is being criminally underrated by everyone across the league and by our own contributors. Last week we did our mid-season all-stars and awards voting, and Trevor Harris wasn't even in the top three for MOP. That is unbelievably insane to me. And I get the arguments in favor of Vernon Adams Jr. and what he's done to turn around the Calgary Stampeders, but Trevor Harris is playing exceptional football right now. He was playing exceptional football at the end of last year. And while I would still lean towards Bo statistically, this is a very serious race down the stretch between these two veteran quarterbacks. And I don't think you can discount Harris at all. He is playing at an incredibly high level.
Scott Milanovic said himself that he believes Trevor Harris is playing the best football of his career. He told me that directly when I sat down with him at Hotel Saskatchewan, because he sees the cut-ups in his film breakdowns, and he's obviously watching closely. Milanovic, knows Harris well, because that's where Harris started his career, was with the Toronto Argonauts when Milanovic was the head coach there. The other question that I'll pose, fellas, and I'm doing this despite some people thinking I might be some type of a homer, is
can it's the in Saskatchewan his contract, guys? Can't be a homer.
Come on. Can the Saskatchewan Roughriders tie or break the record for most wins in a single season by a football team? We saw the Toronto Argos go 16-2 in 2023. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to win the Grey Cup, as we saw with the Argos in 2023, but do we think that that's possible, or is it too early to talk about
it? I mean, nothing's impossible. This is the CFL. To me, though, I think the answer is 16 is the max you can win. I don't think in this era of, you know, game load management, 18-game seasons, free agency, all those things, I don't think it's possible to win more than 16 or lose fewer than two. We have seen one-win teams in the CFL before. Sorry to bring that up, Tiger Cats fans. This has not been a good podcast for your team so far. But I don't think it's possible to win more than 16 or lose more, or lose fewer than two. I really don't. Could the Riders win 16? I mean, it's not impossible. Let's look at their schedule. We just mentioned the three that they've got coming up. Tough games. Week 15, they've got Montreal. Then they've got Edmonton, Ottawa, Toronto, Winnipeg, and BC. The issue that lies here, obviously, is let's say the Riders win their next four, right? They're 12-1. They've got five games left. Well, you're not playing Trevor Harris, right, for all those games. You're not playing AJ Ouellette all those games. You're not playing, like, why would you have, you know, for meaningless regular season games towards the end of the year? Yeah, you can't shut guys down for a month, but, like, why would you, going into Winnipeg in week 20, play anybody who you're willing to risk for the playoffs? Like, Roland Milligan is not playing that game. Blake Carney's not playing that game. Like, it doesn't make sense. So, no, I don't think they'll get to 16 wins, but, you know, who knows? It could theoretically happen.
I agree with you, Hodge. And the flip side of that is you won't be playing your best players in those games because you're resting them for the playoffs. But those could be desperation moment games where both Winnipeg and BC in what could be a very tight playoff race, either for that last spot in the West Division or the crossover. So if you're playing opponents who are fighting for their lives and you've got it all sewed up already because you are as good as you have been this season, that puts you at a real disadvantage down the stretch. I think this is probably a 14 or 15 win Saskatchewan team as it stands right now.
Toronto Argonauts will play three extra away games in 2026 as the FIFA World Cup takes over BMO Field and BC Place, for that matter, in June and July, though these will technically be called home games, air quotes. For all intents and purposes, they are road games. Like, for example, the Riders are selling that 10th game as part of their season seat package in Saskatchewan. The Argos will face the Riders at Mosaic Stadium, the Bombers in Winnipeg, the Ticats in Hamilton. Do we believe that this was the best solution for the soccer scheduling conflict?
I think that depends on what you mean by best. Is this the logistically easiest and potentially most financially prudent way to solve this issue? Yeah. I know that in past years, when the Argonauts have been the quote unquote home team for Touchdown Atlantic, for instance, essentially the way that works is the CFL cuts the Argos a check and says, well, we want to buy a home game from you. Admittedly, I don't know what a home game costs, but essentially the Argonauts get a flat rate. This money hits our coffers. And at that point, the CFL takes over all the responsibility for quote unquote hosting the game, obviously at a neutral site in the Maritimes in those two cases, at least since the pandemic. But they're then in charge of the security and all the logistics and the concessions and everything that goes into hosting a game, right? And I don't know the details of how this came about. I would imagine that the Riders and Bombers and Ticats either simply cut a check and said, yeah, we'll buy a home game from you. And so therefore you're compensated. And then we'll try to make money on the game after we quote unquote, again, bought this game from you. Or maybe it's a little more creative than that. There's some type of rev share. Hey, we're not going to pay you up front for hosting this game, but you'll get X percent of the gate, X percent of concessions, X percent of parking, whatever. I know the Bombers are selling this game included as part of that package. Season ticket holders in Winnipeg can opt out before January 31st. This should, I would expect, be an added cost to that ticket. But I'm sure lots of Bomber fans are thrilled to get a 10th home game, essentially, in 2026, as I'm sure fans in Hamilton and Saskatchewan are. And on the flip side, when it comes to a nurturing your fans, when it comes to creativity, when it comes to building your brand, this is a huge fail, and also a football fail, which is maybe the most important thing for the Toronto Argonauts. I can't imagine being Ryan Dinwiddie or anybody else in that building saying, hey, yeah, you're going to go on the road 12 times next year. And you're, by the way, going to have to play extra games in arguably the three hardest places to play. Like Winnipeg, I think, is the number one hardest place to play. And Saskatchewan and Hamilton are probably right there, 2 and 3 in one of those two orders. The Riders obviously have more like larger crowds. Hamilton, a little bit smaller, still decent size, a little smaller, but their fans are known for being unbelievably ruthless, right? In the way that they verbally abuse visiting players for 3 hours at a time. So I think that a better solution could have been the University of Guelph, where the Argonauts have very successfully hosted training camps and preseason games. I think some type of neutral site game, whether it was in the Maritimes, whether it was up north, whether it was somewhere, right? We've seen London, Ontario, for instance, beg for a game. Could that game potentially have been played at Wilfrid Laurier University? I know their stadium is undergoing some renovations, but it might be ready for 2026. What about London, Ontario, where Western has a decent sized stadium? Like, there are all kinds of Ontario options. And I would suspect that the Argonauts are going to have some type of arrangement with a sponsor saying, hey, we're chartering a plane for fans to visit Winnipeg, to visit Regina. And that's great for the fans who have the time and the money to take that chartered flight and see an extra game. But this is a losing scenario football-wise for the Argos, and I think ultimately brand-wise, because having these games in Southern Ontario would have been a better solution to saying, hey, yeah, we're going to the prairies for a couple of these. And yeah, the Hamilton game is drivable for Ticats fans. It's trainable for Ticats fans, but they don't, or for Argos fans, but they don't want to be sitting in Ticats Stadium watching the Argos play. Like, to me, this is not a good solution from that side of it at all. And to me, frankly, it speaks of a little bit of laziness, right? This is the simplest solution. It's the financially easiest solution. That, in my opinion, is why this happened. It is not the most creative decision, the most dynamic decision, or the best long-term decision for the Argonauts as a brand.
Let's not sugarcoat this at all. This decision is a slap in the face to your players and a kick in the teeth to your fans. It is utterly indefensible, in my mind, to play three road games, essentially, instead of having a neutral site game or a home game at a different venue, when it appears there are available venues across the province. As you laid out, different collegiate stadiums that you could have built out and somehow hosted a specialty game at that venue. That makes so much more sense. Now, it would have cost more money, and I don't know what the support would be like from the province or the city of Toronto. I would expect there would potentially be some, given the fact that they've brought in the World Cup as an event to uplift their city and are in turn kicking out the Argos. So surely they should be due some compensation. I know that was a fact the last time the BC Lions got kicked out of BC Place and will be on the table again for their situation, which I'll discuss in a moment. But even if you have to spend a little bit of money, and even if you're not getting necessarily the same amount of revenue as you would if you're getting the Saskatchewan Rough Riders ticket revenue for one of their games, you are investing in your fan base. You are saying, you guys matter to us. And with this decision, the Toronto Argonauts have sent a clear message to a fan base that has, you know, been joked about and spit on by the rest of the CFL a lot of times because of their small numbers, and said, you guys do not matter to us. We do not care about you. We are not going to go the extra mile or put in a little bit of effort or spend a little bit of extra money. We are going to take the path of least resistance and take something that matters away from you. And to me, that's just not acceptable. I'm speaking about this as someone in BC, and the Lions are having a similar scenario, right? They have more World Cup games being played in Vancouver than Toronto does. And they are going to be nomads as well. But the way that the Lions are approaching this is, yeah, we're going to have three road games at the start of the season. We're going to have a bye in there. But we're also going to have two specialty site games somewhere in the province. It has not been announced where those are, what the structure of that is going to be, whether that's going to be a temporary stadium in the Lower Mainland, similar to what they did when BC Place was being renovated with the new Empire Field, or if they're going to take it to Vancouver Island or into the interior in Kamloops or Kelowna. All those options are on the table, as I understand it, but they are going to do it in the province of BC for Lions fans and ensure that those games are accessible to them. And Amar Doman, who has a lot of money but doesn't have as much money as MLSC does, is willing to write that check and make sure that it happens because he cares about his fan base. The Toronto Argonauts have sent a message that they don't, and that needs to be called out.
Hodge laid it out well. This is purely a financial decision, and I understand it from that aspect, and I think it does line up with how the league in the past has purchased the game from the Toronto Argonauts for them to go out to Touchdown Atlantic. JC, I think, brings some valid points, but I think if you're looking at it from the league perspective, you want to have some certainty. And then also from television too, right? Like, I think this is a part of it that we need to consider, that from TSN's standpoint, it's much easier to have certainty to put on a broadcast at the stadiums where the Argos are going to play these, quote, home games. Is it disrespectful to their fan base? Yes. Are there stadium options out there, such as the University of Guelph, that would be able to be, I don't want to say retrofit, but upgraded in terms of the amount of seats and then also be able to handle the broadcast capabilities? I believe that could be the case. You know, some people might say, oh, the press box is not quite ideal, but you figure ways around it, right? Like, JC, you were at a Touchdown Victoria and it didn't seem the press area was that great. But the main point I'm trying to make is that wherever you go, I would imagine that some of those conversations would have happened with TSN. I think University of Guelph could have done this very easily, probably would have worked with the league and the Argos to have the team play these three games at the University of Guelph. That is also, you know, trainable. You can take a bus out there for the fans that are coming from the GTA out to Guelph. That to me is a very natural solution, especially when they've already had, you know, multiple preseason games there. I'm not just saying it because I went to university there. Some people mentioned the University of Toronto Varsity Blues Stadium, but the way that that field is constructed, you would essentially have to take down all of the fencing around the end zones and the far side of the field where there is no stands and then put up temporary seats. Like, that would be more of an endeavor. I think there's a chance potentially that you could have played at the York Lions Stadium if we're talking about potential stadiums that are within the GTA area. There's also, you know, other fields like private schools in the area that you could have constructed a whole new stadium. I just don't think that's the way that they would have wanted to go. So I'm thinking, okay, what are some logical spots? I think York could have been one. The U of T setup isn't ideal, but Guelph just makes too much sense to me. And I think London is a valid point, perhaps even going as far as Windsor, I think could have been very intriguing, right? Luke Wilson has been open about the fact that he feels like that's a place that would welcome the CFL with open arms. And I think when you look at it from a purely financial perspective, that yes, this is the best way to maximize your profits, that's great. But I think there are other ways that other business people would look at this, and they would say, okay, if you have a neutral site game in London or Windsor, let's say, one of those two areas, or perhaps even in Kitchener-Waterloo, I don't think they could probably play that game at Laurier, just with what's going on with the stadium there. Waterloo's field is temporary. That's why I think Guelph makes the most sense. But you have a chance to put your product in front of potentially new eyeballs. Like, that to me is a missed marketing opportunity. And instead of just being worried about the profits, you're looking at, okay, an investment in the team's brand for the long-term future. So I get the decision the CFL made. I don't necessarily think it's a lazy one. Stuart Johnston does not strike me as a lazy commissioner. I don't necessarily think that that is fair. but it is less than ideal for Argos fans. I'll tell you, Riders fans are excited about it, as I'm sure they are in Winnipeg, where Hodge is, and I bet the Ticats fans are happy to have another home game there. And the one other point that was made to me, fellas, before I pass the baton here, was the fact that the Riders are going to play a preseason game in Saskatoon. So when I was on the ground in Regina, some people there were like, well, you get this extra home game. Sorry. You get an extra game at your stadium because it's supposed to be the Argos home game. Perhaps that allows the Riders the chance to then say, okay, well, we know that we have that extra game there and the revenue that could come with it. We'll take this opportunity to go up to Saskatoon. So I just don't want to miss that as being a potential positive to this situation, but the rest of it just does not look good, specifically on the Toronto Argonauts and MLSE.
Well, and there were opportunities, right, for the Argos to do something creative and out of the box. And I think the Riders deserve a lot of credit for doing that. They're like, hey, extra game. What could we do for our local community? Or what could we do for our provincial fan base? Because we know so many Rider season ticket holders come from Saskatoon or other surrounding communities around Regina. And they were like, great, boom, we'll use this as an opportunity to do something cool, something unique that, yeah, it's happened before, but not for like decades, right? If you're under the age of 40 or even closer to 50, you don't remember a Riders preseason game in Saskatoon. So they're taking that opportunity. They're getting there at the University of Saskatchewan, a facility that has recently received upgrades. It is in good shape, and they're doing something really neat, something really cool, which I think is great. I do see the other side of it a little bit. Like, this is the second World Cup that's ever going to be held in North America. It's the first one in North America, and I think it's 30 years. So I get maybe the counter argument from the Argos or from the league where it's like, well, why are we going to host a neutral site touchdown Atlantic style game if we're not going to get, you know, front page coverage? If we're not, like, if we're going to be kind of white noise in this, you know, giant, unbelievable juggernaut that is the World Cup, because I wouldn't expect anybody, heck, the NFL would have a hard time competing with the World Cup. The World Cup is a global, that. On a global level, the World Cup is a bigger deal than the Super Bowl. I don't know about the tournament necessarily all the way through, but certainly the end of the World Cup gets more eyeballs. It gets more attention than the Super Bowl. So I would never expect the CFL to say, yeah, we're going to take on the World Cup and win. But still, like, to even just to do one neutral site game, one thing, and the easy one is
to have the Ticats Argos game at the University of Guelph. Like, that to me is the tapping.
Yeah,
that should have been the bare minimum, right?
And like, also the World Cup schedule, I'm pretty sure, has been out forever, right? So you can try to schedule this game on a day where there are no games happening in North America. But
I don't think that would have been possible. You mean to play in Toronto at BMO?
No, not a BMO. I'm saying if you host a neutral site game somewhere in the Maritimes, somewhere out west, somewhere north, or you do a game at Guelph, as you said, you could try to schedule that game on a day where there are no soccer games, no World Cup matches to be played across the country. So you, at least on that day, you can kind of own the news cycle by doing something unique. Hey, look, the Argos are in this place, or the Argos are there, or what have you. I'm not suggesting that the Argos could play that game at BMO. I'm just saying in general, you could try to schedule that game for a day where you get at least a little bit of a reprieve from the World Cup, which we know will be all over the place. Personally, I'm not terribly interested in the World Cup, but I understand that most sports fans are. So
it could have been in Guelph.
You don't want to compete with it. It could have been in Guelph. Yeah,
to me, that's an easy one, right? Like Ticats, Argos, and Guelph. The Tiger Cats. What year was that?
That was, I think, 2011, 2012, or maybe I'm a little early.
2013 or 2014. They played all their home games in Guelph. Like
they did.
I think that would have been a great way to put your product, regular season product, that is, in front of some new fans in a place where the Tiger Cats have called home before, where the Argos call home, you know, for one preseason game in training camp. Like, to me, that's the easy one.
Yeah.
But then we're talking about here, you know, the broadcast quality. I don't believe TSN has ever broadcast a preseason game from the University of Guelph. But like, okay, back in the day, some people might laugh at me, but the Score did just fine broadcasting University Rush games from the University of Guelph Stadium. There's a brand new, beautiful pavilion that is set up there. And I'm certain that if you went to the powers that be at the University of Guelph, and I'll name one, I don't think I'll mind, Stu Lang, and said, hey, I'm going to have a regular season game here. If you make some upgrades, then you could probably get it. he would do that, or that the University of Guelph would be into that. I think they have looked at, you know, potentially a new press box and stuff there. So to me, that's the one that really stands out. I get the other two, and I think that's why it was important to mention the preseason game in Saskatoon that's going to take place with the Riders going up there. So when I really break it down even more and we talk about it, it's like, you know, how's that game not at the University of Guelph or London or wherever else? Like Ticats, Argos, two Ontario teams could have been done.
Don, for those of us who don't live in Ontario, how long is the drive from Toronto to Guelph?
I mean, depends on traffic and all that stuff, but like downtown Toronto or from the GTA, like let's say Mississauga or Etobicoke out to Guelph, it can be as little as an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. If it's traffic, it's more, but it's not much.
So to Hodge's point, if you have this game within that type of proximity to Toronto when the World Cup is going on, I mean, not only are you catering to your own fans and rendering it accessible to them, but there's another element here too, where we've spent all the last number of years, you know, debating about, you know, the global program and whether the CFL can ever get international eyeballs. Well, the world is coming to Toronto, and rather than giving them a CFL game within an hour where you can say, hey, come be a part of this Canadian experience on a day off, you can see another type of sport and maybe engage in that, sell some tickets that way. We're saying, I'm going to take it to a different part of the country where none of that is possible, right? Like, to me, that feels like another mistake where you can outreach to an entirely different contingent of future CFL fans, of people who are visiting Toronto because of those games. It's just a missed opportunity all around.
Yeah, come see a real football game where players don't pretend to be hurt every 90 seconds. Just a thought. Like, but yeah. And by the way, women don't do that. So shout out women's soccer players.
In fairness,
I like watching women's soccer more than men's soccer.
Tiger Shanks pretended to be hurt for the entirety of Montreal's game last night so that Nick Callender could play left tackle. So that's not entirely true.
This is true. And Shanks, by the way, allowed zero sacks. Callender, I'm pretty sure, allowed at least one. But whatever. We're getting beside the point here. Speaking of the Alouettes, the Montreal Alouettes have lost three straight games and three straight quarterbacks, as Caleb Evans was the latest passer to suffer what appeared to be a serious injury in Saturday's loss to the Lions. Former fourth-round NFL draft pick James Morgan threw for 211 yards, one touchdown, and one interception in a relief effort. He could presumably be the starter in Week 12 against Winnipeg, though Cameron Dukes is also an option for the Owls after signing with the team last week. JC, should Alouettes fans be pressing the panic button?
I think they should, right? This is a important slide. They are losing games in the East Division. They are losing ground. And the thing that concerns me more than losing Caleb Evans is the fact that there does not yet seem to be clarity regarding when Davis Alexander is going to be back. And he's on the 6-game injured list right now. But every time Jason Moss has been asked, they've said, well, it's a complicated injury. It's tough to judge, and when he's ready, we're going to wait an extra week. And that has been the refrain the entire time. It's something that has nagged him since training camp, guys. So this has been several months at this point, and he does not seem to be much closer to being on the field. Now, I'm sure Moss is playing things close to the vest. We don't know the details exactly of how Alexander is feeling at this exact moment. But if he continues to miss games, I just don't see this Alouettes offense as being capable of winning football games, right? They can't score touchdowns right now. They can't keep up with opponents. And as good as their defense has been, they just don't have the horsepower. So that really concerns me. And if I'm an Alouettes fan, I am checking Twitter, you know, 10, 15 times a day just to see if there's an update on Alexander. Right now, there hasn't been one, and I don't know how much longer you can afford to have performances like the one that they've had.
I don't think I'm pressing the panic button quite yet. Davis Alexander, it seems like, is going to come back at some point, and he's still undefeated as a starter, and that's a very difficult trip for Montreal to go all the way across the country to try to win in BC. What was the note that we had, fellas? The last quarterback to win out there was Tanner Marsh in 2015?
Actually, it appears the CFL was inaccurate with that because Rakeem Cato started that game. Tanner Marsh only played through three passes. But yes, it was 2015 with Rakeem Cato and Tanner Marsh combining their efforts.
Ratanner Karsh. That's who won the game. Ratanner Karsh.
CFL, man, come on. Like, it's so bad that you keep getting this stuff wrong. Dude, it just, like, they say the stats are fixed and they're broken a bunch of times this weekend. Like, Genius Sports, whoever it is over there, get it figured out, okay? Genius Sports and the CFL need to be pressing the panic button, like, years ago on the CFL stats. The Owls, I don't think, need to be. Because, like, look at the rest of the East Division, okay? The Toronto Argonauts, Ryan Dinwiddie, is about to absolutely erupt. Like, I thought he was going to pull a Jason Moss on the sideline there and stomp on his headset and knock over some Gatorade jugs and just go berserk. Honestly, credit to him.
He did kind of throw a headset.
Keeping his wits like about him.
He kind of threw it, but then he didn't just dust it completely. I would say he didn't go full Moss, but he was like Ma. Like, he was halfway there. Yeah, he wasn't full Moss. He was half Moss. He Ma. He was Ma.
At least he wasn't Mike Sherman and didn't get tangled up in his shirt.
It was big old belly hanging out.
Oh, boy.
I just don't think if you're Montreal, you need to press the panic button quite yet. They're banged up on the back end. You know, ideally from that standpoint, Noel Thorpe and his group will get healthier. And I do think that, you know, James Morgan was at least, I thought, pretty good in his first lengthy CFL action. Difficult spot for him to go into. Maybe pretty good is not the term, but better than decent. So if he's going to be the starter in a better situation for him, you know, at home, it's a short week for them playing Winnipeg, but I think that could be a better setup. So I'm not pressing the panic button quite yet because it seems like Davis Alexander is going to be back at some point. Just don't ask Jason Moss. But, like, Davis Alexander's out here all animated on the sideline. Like, you would think that at some point here in the near future, he could be back on the field.
I think that the Montreal Alouettes are not only not yet at a point where they should be pressing the panic button, their fans should be a 0 out of 10 concerned. Like, honestly, there is zero pressure on this team right now. Marc-Antoine Dacroix is out, will be back. KB Onyenko is out, will be back. Justin Lawrence is out, will be back. Austin Mack is out, will be back. Tyson Philpott is out, will be back. Davis Alexander is out, will be back. Mustafa Johnson is out, will be back. Like, the Alouettes just learned this lesson last year. It doesn't matter what you look like in August, as long as you make the playoffs. It matters what you look like in November. And guess what? They were great during the regular season, had a little QB controversy thrown in there towards the end of the year, and then came out flat in the East Final and committed a bunch of turnovers, right? And they got hosed. What they need to do this year is just be ready for November. And right now, there's no reason to think they won't be. They're going to get all these guys back. Yeah, their defense got lit up against Nathan Rourke, but that was largely because they spent so much time on the field. They got so banged up, and their secondary is banged up, right? If guys are tired and you're missing a bunch of your starters on the back end, yeah, Nathan Rourke is going to take one to you. But this team started the year 5-2, and for the 100th time, it's time to officially retire the lazy old narrative of the CFL season doesn't start till Labor Day. Because guess what? The Alouettes essentially punched their playoff ticket come the end of July, right? Like, you look at the standings, they're up 4 points on Ottawa, up 6 points on Toronto. The Argonauts have fallen. They can't get up. And the Red Blacks, I think, can make actual headway here, but the Alouettes already have one up them in the season series. Like the Alouettes have the season series against Toronto. They're 2-0 with one game left to come, and they're 1-0 against Ottawa with two games. So if you're the Alouettes, if you just split those last two with the Red Blacks, you're good to go, baby. Like, you got the tiebreaker. You're essentially up 5 points at that point. Like, you are in the driver's seat. You are controlling your own destiny. And I don't think they need to panic at all, right? There's a ton of talent on that team. Obviously, losing sucks, but they're 500. That's not a bad, it's not a good record, but it's not a bad record. Alouettes do not need to panic at any point. They are the anti-Elks, right? The Elks have won two straight games. They need to be pressing the panic button. Why? Because everybody else won this week in your division. The BC Lions, impressive win. Winnipeg Blue Bombers, snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. And the Riders, I mean, you're not catching the Riders. Stamps are technically catchable for the Elks, but they got to obviously take care of business Labor Day and the rematch. Like, the Elks need to be pressing the panic button. more. And that's not even entirely their fault. It is partly just the way the divisions stack up. The Alouettes are still in a good spot. I don't care if they've lost three straight. They're in a good spot. They are.
The Alouettes aren't so much in control of their own destiny as their medical staff is in control of their destiny. I mean, that's essentially what you lay out. This team's going to be good if they get this guy back, and if they get this guy, and when this guy comes back. Like, the injuries matter, and we don't exactly know all the timelines on all of these injuries or if those guys will be the same players when they come back, because sometimes when you're playing through stuff, you're just not the same guy, right? That's just the nature of football. And right now, Ottawa is close enough that it would make me nervous if I'm the Alouettes. And if Ottawa can get a leg up on you, and again, they've got their own injury concerns with Drew Brown and whether he'll be able to play next week after exiting a game yet again with an injury, but they can look pretty good when he's firing on all cylinders and they've got that receiving core going. If they're able to sneak one by you and jump over you in the standings, then you're worried about the BCs and the Winnipegs of the world who are in contention for that crossover spot. And I just don't think you can rest on your laurels as the Montreal Alouettes and say, well, look at what we looked at like at the start of the season. Clearly, we'll get back to that at some point. That's not a guarantee by any stretch of the imagination. And if we want to sit here and say that the season doesn't start until Labor Day is a misnomer and a bad saying, then we can't say that the games that are happening right now and the losses that are happening right now don't matter either. I think they matter, and the Alouettes have some things to figure out.
But how'd you say they don't matter because of the fast start they got off to?
If the Red Blacks were a 6-win team and the Argos were a 5-win team and the Ticats were undefeated, yeah, Alouettes need to be smashing the panic button. What I'm saying is they are being chased by a turtle and a snail right now. If I'm not a fast man, but if I'm being chased by a turtle and a snail, I'm feeling good about my chances. I'm not saying that the Red Blacks can't pick it up. I'm not saying that the Argos can't pick it up. Red Blacks were a playoff team last year. Argos are the reigning Grey Cup champs. I'm not trying to disrespect those teams, but combined, they have as many wins as the Alouettes do right now. That's my point, is that to this point, they have not been sharp.
I'm telling you, I saw a turtle at my nephew's baseball game this season. No, yo, I'm not even joking. I'm not even joking. This baseball field in Guelph is by a river, and this turtle, multiple times during the game, was picked up, set back by the river, made its way all the way back into the infield. We're talking about across a path, all the way through the outfield, back onto the infield multiple times. And if you went near that thing, he was moving, bro. Like, I want no part of that turtle.
This has been Nature with Justin on the Three Down Podcast.
I wanted no part of that turtle. That is my favorite part of that.
I'm serious. I'll show you guys the video. I got it on my phone.
Okay. Cool. It's moving. You should post it to Twitter that we could all see it. Hashtag turtle talk.
We'll see.
Oh boy.
JC's saying the Red Blacks could be like the Guelph Turtle in this example and jump up and snatch a playoff spot away from Montreal.
Speaking of the Red Blacks, by the way, really quick, I have now seen Drew Brown play in person 3 times, and he has, as a member of the Red Blacks, I obviously saw him lots of times in Winnipeg, but as a member of the Red Blacks, I've seen him start 3 games in person. He's gotten knocked out of all 3 games. So I'm going to get out ahead of this. Fans in Ottawa, when you guys come to Winnipeg next year, I will start a vacation fund. I will accept donations to not go to that game. I want to go to Japan. That's next on my bucket list. That's an expensive trip. So if y'all could help, I would be happy to go to Japan and skip out on that Winnipeg Red Blacks game.
The John Hodge curse.
It's a curse. It's a curse. It really is.
He's out here with a sniper rifle from the press box, just taking out Drew Brown. He's on the grassy knoll.
It's not what can Brown do for you. It's what have you done to Brown?
I haven't done nothing to Drew Brown. Don't put that evil on me. I have done nothing to Drew Brown.
That's what you just said. You said all 3 times you've been there, he's gotten hurt, bro.
Well, I meant more in the sense of like a curse or something ominous like that. JC is trying to make me out of some type of sniper. I don't understand that. I've never fired a gun, ever.
I see you snipe lots of food, bro. You got accuracy you want.
When I used to live in Western Manitoba, there was one morning where I came out to my car and there were giant, giant paw prints surrounding my vehicle. Like huge paw prints, like dinner plate size paw prints. Oh, not dinner plate, but like lunch plate, like sandwich plate size. And I remember talking to one of my it was the Guelph turtle.
From Guelph.
I remember talking to a colleague at the time and I'm like, I said, I think it was wolves. Like, what do I do if there's wolves around my car? And they're like, oh, just shoot them. I'm like, with what? And they're like, your gun. And I'm like, I don't have that. I missed the memo on that. Fortunately, I lived there for 6 years, never saw a wolf around my car, but I was a little, that was like the first couple months of me living there. So I thought this is going to happen all the time. It never happened again.
But, careful, Hodge. Yeah, PETA might be listening to this. Don't be shooting animals.
Right. Yeah. PETA. Yeah. Shout out PETA.
And be respectful to that damn turtle too. Yes. Yeah. Your grill, picked
him
up and that.
Moved him nicely.
You shouldn't move him at all. If Franklin wants to run the bases, Franklin can run the bases. Okay?
Bro, what if Franklin's going to get stepped on?
Well, you should suspend
and
play.
Die. Until he's able,
you should suspend the play until he can go around the full diamond.
Well, the turtle's about to lay eggs in there, bro. Like, game would be over. You can't have that.
I don't know. PETA would still be mad if you let him run the bases.
It would be. Just like Michael Shea is mad at the media. He elected to have Sergio Castillo try a 57-yard field goal with a little over a minute left against the Ottawa Redblacks on Thursday to try to take a 10-point lead. Instead, Castillo was wide on the attempt. Khalil Pimpleton popped, brought it all the way back for a 117-yard missed field goal return. Tutty tied the game. The Bombers did eventually win. O'Shea doubled down post-game saying, quote, it was a pretty easy decision, close quote, to kick the field goal. Did he make the right choice?
No, this was a bad choice. I was sitting in the press box thinking, okay, third and two. And it was like, I don't even know if it was a full two. It was maybe one and a half. It's like, you could run an offensive play. And if you get a first down, you basically win the game. Or at least at that point, I think there was a 1:11 left at that point. And I think the Red Blacks had a timeout, if I'm remembering correctly. So you run an offensive play. Let's say you get the first down. You let the clock go down once. If you don't get a first down on second down, the Red Blacks can maybe call time. That gets you to 30 seconds, right? And you're making the field goal shorter by doing that. Instead, 57 yards. Like, don't get me wrong. Sergio Castillo, brilliant kicker. He's honestly my pick for Bombers MOP right now, which I think also says stuff about what the rest of the team looks like at this point in time. Not a brilliant season so far for the Blue Bombers, but regardless, Serge has been incredible. Just last week, ties the all-time CFL record with a 63-yard field goal. That needs to be noted. But a 57-yard field goal is a low percentage kick, relatively speaking, for anybody. And obviously, when you're kicking a kick that long, you have a heavier unit out there to protect because the ball's trajectory is going to be low. Those kicks can take a little more time to take place. And so you're watching the cover team, and the cover team has like 340-pound guard Gabe Wallace and 285-pound nose tackle Jake Thomas. And it's like, I'm sorry, you're expecting these gentlemen to tackle Khalil Pimpleton, who pound for pound might be the fastest player in the CFL. Like, I remember watching Sergio go out for that kick up from the press box, who's on the opposite side of the field to us, thinking this could be going back for seven. Like, I know that's not the most likely outcome here, but this could realistically be going back for seven. And of course, that is exactly what took place. Now, credit the Bombers for getting the win regardless. But post game, Mike O'Shea was as upset as I've seen him. And he didn't seem to be upset with his players. He championed his players in the way that they rallied, which is cool. A coach should be supportive of their players after a win. I get that. But he seemed to be mad at us. It was me and three other reporters, a bit of a smaller contingent than his usual, after a Bomber game. But I opened the questioning by just saying, how's it going, coach? Which typically Mike O'Shea likes to answer. He did not answer that question. I said general thoughts, and he's basically like, yeah, we won. And I'm like, okay. And then I ask him about the decision, and I asked, well, you know, Jamison Sheehan, their punter. I'm like, well, he could have buried the Red Blacks deep because the Bombers, full credit to them, their punt coverage was excellent all game. And he was like, well, and I think he thought that I was suggesting they should have tried to kick like or punt like a 67-yard rouge or something like that. I'm like, no. I'm not saying the rouge. I'm saying like just bury them deep. He's like, well, you know, we could have done that, but it was a pretty easy decision to send out Sergio. And then when talking to Paul Friesen, veteran reporter who's been doing it for 35 years at a high level, you know, he basically, like, in real time was editing the media. He's like, well, I'm sensing there's negativity that's going to come from here. And he kind of gestured at us, I think, I assume meaning the media. And then he's like, you know, we have lots of resilience coming from our players, and maybe you should write about that. And it's like, I've been around Mike O'Shea as a reporter for 7-8 years. I've watched his media avails dating back to when he first got hired back in 2014. I've never seen him try to edit the media in real time. And I thought that that was shocking. Honestly, I wasn't offended by it, but the reason I mention it is because I think when you're a secure coach who's really secure in what it is you're doing, and Mike O'Shea, I think, is one of few coaches who genuinely doesn't read or really listen to what the media reports. You don't care what the media has to say. You just care what's going on in your building. And I don't think things are as hunky-dory in Winnipeg's locker room as they've been in past years. And I thought this might be some good evidence that that's the case, right? Mm-hmm. If you're really secure in what's going on in your building, you don't feel the need to edit the media in real time. If you are not feeling secure about your decision, if you're not feeling secure about what's going on in your building, then you are more likely to jump down a reporter's throat. And so I hated the decision, and I didn't particularly care for O'Shea. Again, it didn't offend me, but I was more taken aback by O'Shea feeling like he needed to do this. It was bizarre behavior from someone who I've never really seen behave that way before.
Hodge, you and I have had very different experiences in the press room this week, because you got told what to write by Mike O'Shea, and Nathan Rourke said he always endeavors to make me personally happy with his performances. So it's a much different vibe out here in BC.
He's a people
pleaser. Of course
he
was joking. Yes. And you know what? He made me very happy this week. I got to write about a win and a strong performance, but that's beside the point. This decision by O'Shea was indefensible, and I would have liked him to take much more responsibility for it after the game. I understand that Castillo can hit from distance, but of all the options that were on the table to him at that point in the game when you're up by 7, this was the worst one. I have no problem if you want to be aggressive and you want to end the game, which I think is O'Shea's argument as to why he sent out the kicker. It would make it a 2-score game, 10 points. The Red Blacks would have had a tough time coming back from that. I get that argument. But if you're going to do that and be aggressive, then you put your big brass cojones on the table and you send out Chris Streveler, who is the best sneaker in the league, arguably, and you get 2 yards.
Whoa,
and you
whoa, convert that. Whoa. Tommy Stevens has something to say about that, bro.
Wow. There's a debate between the two of them. I'll acknowledge that.
I don't even think it's close, but we can save that for later.
Also, though, we can also, especially for a play that's over a yard, maybe just be an offense. Like, just run a play. Getting 2 yards is
okay,
not
but
that
if we're going to talk about this, then what if Mike O'Shea goes for it
100 times
on third
a year?
Down what? And the Bombers don't get it? Well, then he looks terrible, too.
Well, I don't think that's the case, because then you can say, wow, the offense should be able to get 2 yards.
Yeah. I agree with Hodge. And I'm not saying that that's the correct decision. I'm just saying if you're aggressive, there's actually less risk with that, because then the Red Blacks have to march the field than setting one of the best returners in the CFL up for a prime return in a big moment, right? Because when you've got the field goal unit out there trying to defend against Khalil Pimpleton on a high percentage or a low percentage kick that could potentially miss, you're in a bad situation. And there's a high likelihood that that can be returned for a score, versus if you turn the ball over at midfield, they still have to do the job of an offense and march down the field to convert that. So if you're going to be aggressive, do that. Personally, I would have punted the damn ball, and I would have tried to pin them at the 1 and make them go the entire distance of the field. That's a more conservative call, but I think it was the correct one in that instance when you're already up by a converted touchdown. There is no reason that you had to be as aggressive or as points hungry as Mike O'Shea was and do it in a way that was more risky than any other. That is a coaching failure. And I'm not saying Mike O'Shea is not a good coach, because he's as good as they come. And I have tremendous amount of respect for what he's done in building that culture in Winnipeg. But that culture has been built on people taking responsibility for their actions, their mistakes, and their play, and being accountable to the other people in that locker room. And I don't think in this instance, Mike O'Shea was as accountable as he needed to be for what was ultimately his call.
To me, that part of it is fair. And then we also have to realize, you know, just like we joked about Jason Moss or Ryan Dinwiddie, that sometimes when you get these coaches or players post-game, they're still in the heat of the game. Like, they just came from the sideline, you know, minutes ago. Varying coaches do it at, you know, varying times after the final seconds have gone off the clock. But I think we need to factor that into this decision. And then also, like, Mike O'Shea, arguably, for the last five CFL seasons, has been the best game manager, field position manager in the Canadian Football League. Yes or no?
Yeah, I would say yes.
He's up there for sure.
Okay, probably yes from both of you. So I just don't want to get too focused in here on one decision, because I think what happens a lot of times with hot takes in sports, and I get that, we should have opinions. I agree with John Hodge. Otherwise, it would be boring. He said that on the pod last week. But that if he goes for it on 3rd-and-1.5 or 2 with Chris Trevler and they get stuffed and the Red Blacks go down the field and score a touchdown, he's going to get similar type questions. Well, why didn't you trot Sergio Castillo out there? I'm not saying that he made the right decision. It's just I think too often we look at this from the result instead of the decision that was made, the history that he has, and the possibilities here. You know, I would probably lean towards JC in terms of possibly punting the football there, but these decisions go so freaking quickly in the CFL with the play clock. I'm not making that an excuse for him, but I'm just saying, like, especially in the game, it happens in a snap. And if you think Sergio Castillo, Hodge, is the MOP of this team, then why not send your best player out there to end the game? Like, if that's how highly we're talking about Sergio Castillo, why would you put the ball in Chris Trevler's hands? I get the idea of leaving the offense out there. I'm just trying to provide some balance here. The one question that I would have reasonable. That I don't know if we'll get answered is usually for your field goal cover units, you have a short field goal unit, for lack of a better term, and then you have a long field goal cover unit. So did the Bombers actually have that faster cover unit on the field? I think that would have been a smart question to find out, or answer to find out.
Well, I can watch the film and tell you, knowing that Gabe Wallace was trotting down the field, who's having a great season, by the way, along the offensive line, like, he's a very good player, but you're not sending a 340-pound blocker out there to tackle Khalil Pimpleton.
Like, hey, so Gabe Wallace was a hell of a rugby player back in his day. He can tackle. He can tackle.
Would you send him out to cover Khalil Pimpleton? Yes or no?
That's one guy, though. Who else was on the field? You can't just single out one guy.
Well, there were multiple. I'm using him as an example. Jake Thomas was out there. I'd have to look at the full unit, but the core four, at least from that unit, were heavy linemen, like DTs and O linemen. So
that's valid. And that's where I would drill down on.
Okay, fair enough. And by the way, nobody got close to Khalil Pimpleton. Like he was untouched. It wasn't like there was, you know, he made some incredible cut, and it was just like, oh my god, like, the Bombers didn't get within a sniff of Khalil Pimpleton. If he was wearing cologne, nobody got a whiff of what it was, what the smell was, right? That is the problem. And I appreciate what you're saying about results versus strategy, right? Obviously, if Sergio Castillo makes the kick, yeah, we're probably not talking about it. I just think there's three choices. There's the punt, there's the gamble, and there's the field goal. I think that the field goal, yeah, if you make it, it's probably a 50-50 kick. If you make it, yeah, you win. But if you miss, there is a potential disaster scenario. And for me, that's why it's the third of three choices. I would have probably gone with the punt. Yes, there is a small percentage chance that it's going to get returned for a touchdown. But if you're, and again, Sheehan was having a great game. He's having a good season. If he puts that ball in the corner, then there's an exceptionally low chance that Pimpleton brings it out for a big gain. The Red Blacks probably scrimmage somewhere between the 15 and the 20. And then you're having a backup quarterback who, by the way, the Red Blacks, one completion at the start of the game for 40 yards. Everything else was basically underneath all game. They did not push the ball deep, and that's not what Dustin Crum does, right? Forcing him to go the length of the field in a minute, not a bad situation to be in. And then the gamble, like, what's a better percentage chance? A 57-yard field goal hitting or converting on 3rd-and-2?
I'm just saying there's variables here. Even with the punt. If Shea and punts and Dustin Crum drives the field, everybody's going to be like, Michael Shea, why'd you punt the football? You know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm talking about, the result with this. I think the other option there could extend it to four is, like what you said earlier, to potentially lead the offense on the field. Like, you have the reigning MOP in the backfield.
Option three, yeah. Well, option two, I think, is – like, there's only three choices. There's punt, gamble, or kick. I would have gone punt. I think second choice is gamble. I would have left field goal as a third choice. Just
so my
because
four
of
options would be
scenario.
Field goal, punt, short yardage unit with Chris Trevler, or the offense on the field with the reigning MVP and Zach Kolaris. And this is where I'm trying to drill down on this. Like, okay, if Sergio Castillo makes a kick, are you asking Mike O'Shea about that decision? Because technically, by what you and JC are saying here, you should have.
True.
But you're not doing it. You said you wouldn't do it based on the results of the play. Like, as
the
media, we got to realize that.
For the record, though, whether or not Hodge would have asked it, because sometimes when things happen, right, there's an order of priority to the questions that you have to ask. You don't have unlimited time.
Yeah, that's it.
And when something is successful, then it gets bumped down the order of priorities. But, you know, in our group chat,
Would you ask that field goal unit,
right? We were asking the question then. So it was something we were skeptical of in the moment. Whether it was successful or not, we still had the same question. It's just, would it have been as high a priority to ask about in that moment if it had been successful? Probably not. But I think it still would have been a decision worth talking about. And it was one we were already discussing before it even happened.
Yeah, if I get Osh for 20 minutes one-on-one after the game, I'm asking that question regardless. If I'm getting him as part of, again, it was just four reporters this time, which is smaller than normal. Usually it's six or seven. And we're getting him for 6 minutes, 7 minutes. Yeah, I'm probably not asking him about it because it's just not going to hit that priority check, right? For instance, I did not ask Osh, and I should have, this is my fault, about his decision not to challenge either of the PIs on Cam Allen, both of which I thought were marginal at best, and also the non-face mask on Dylan Mitchell, where it looked like Bryce Carter got his hand up potentially in that grill of his. So there are a number of times where O'Shea could have thrown his challenge flag in the first half, and he didn't. And I should have asked about that, and I didn't, because at the end of the game, there's so much chaos where it's like, oh my. So in a perfect world, yes, I would ask the question. Admittedly, had Serge made the kick, I probably wouldn't have, just because the priorities weren't there.
I'm just trying to play the other side. And too many
and
times in the media,
point.
We have hot takes based on the result, not the process and the history. That's why I asked a question off the top about Mike O'Shea and his field management. He's been so good at winning the field possession battle over the last 5 years. That's a major reason why the Bombers have been in five straight Grey Cups. I'm not saying they haven't had great players too. They have. But in this instance, he felt like Sergio Castillo kicking the field goal was the best way to essentially end that football game. I get how people can get upset. I can understand O'Shea's decision. I'm not even necessarily sure of what I would have done in that situation. I'm just presenting like all the sides of this, right? Because what if Chris Trevler got stuffed? Red Blacks go down the field with Dustin Crum and score. Same thing. What if the offense was on the field in third and two, gave it to Brady Oliveira, and he got stuffed? Like, we're having the same question about the play call, and if Castillo's been hot and banging them through, you know, I don't necessarily mind it. Some people might think I'm crazy, though, and that's fine.
The one thing I will throw out before we move on, because I know you're itching to talk about Taylor Algersma, is back in 2016, the Bombers were in BC playing the Lions in the West Semi, and instead of gambling on, I think it was third and four, Mike O'Shea trotted out Justin Medlock for a 60-yard field goal, and Medlock, who doesn't usually kick off a tee, brought a tee out and hammered it as hard as he could, and the ball fell short. Now, kicking in Winnipeg is easier than kicking in Vancouver, because kicking in a dome, I think, talking to kickers, they say it generally takes a yard or two off the ball just because the air is kind of dead, as opposed to an outdoor situation. So this field goal was a better situation, and it was a little bit shorter. But Mike O'Shea, after that game, doubled down on the decision, saying, no, I don't question it. I know the offense was hot, but I trust Medlock to go make that kick, blah, blah, blah. Well, years later, I remember talking to somebody who knows Mike O'Shea very well about that kick. And he said, I called Mike like a week after that kick and said, what the heck did you just choose? And O'Shea admitted, yeah, okay, maybe I shouldn't have kicked the ball. Right. So like, I do believe Mike O'Shea has kind of gone through this similar process. I'm not saying it's exactly the same situation, but he has gone through his own process of previously kicking a field goal that was very long in a game where he had the opportunity to try a short third down gamble late in a key game, and he opted for the kick and regretted it and admitted it, not publicly, but privately, according to my source.
That one was a little bit different to me because Justin Medlock was very accurate, but yep. he hadn't shown the propensity that Sergio Castillo has to kick these 50-plus yard field goals. I'm not saying Medlock True. Couldn't have hit it, but your point there about him bringing the tee out, I think, changes that whole idea.
Yeah, so again, it's not exactly the same situation, but they kind of echo each other. There's some similarities. So that, I think, has fed into my reporting of this as well, because I think every coach is entitled to early career mistakes. Granted, Mike O'Shea was in year three by that point, but that was his first playoff game. And I think he left it going, you know, oh, shoot, I probably should have handled this differently. And this is the first time since then I can think of him late in a game, granted it's 9 years later, but going, yeah, let's try the extremely long field goal. No disrespect to Serge. Serge is again, an elite kicker. Funnily enough, he told the media after the game, he hit the 57-yarder really well. He just misaimed it. The 47-yarder he actually made to win the game, he said he actually mishit. He hit it with his toe, and he thought it was going to miss, and he felt like it was lucky that it went in. Now, that's also irrelevant because Ottawa had too many men on the field, which is like a completely separate issue of just the utter chaos that was the last 75 seconds of that game. But whatever. Let's move on.
Canadian quarterback Taylor Elgersma played his second NFL preseason game with the Green Bay Packers and looked good, leading three scoring drives while completing 7 of 11 pass attempts for 109 yards in roughly 1.5 quarters of action against the Indianapolis Colts. Dunk, did this performance help his cause?
Most certainly. I'm buying Taylor Elgersma stock because it is on the way up, fellas. Get it while it's hot. He played more in that second preseason game than Sean Clifford did, who came into training camp as the number three quarterback. And fellas,
sorry, there's a bear right outside my window.
What?
Yeah. And there's a what? Cub. I'm right a by the bear? Window. And a bear. Yeah, just walked by the window.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. They're out there having a good time, but that startled me. And in this nature-themed podcast, I thought we should. We talked about turtles and wolves, and now there's a bear appearance.
Make sure all your doors are closed. Don't be like that viral video where the bear walked into somebody's house because the door was left open. You guys see that?
We can get the bear's opinion on Mike Jose's decision. Like, he might want to weigh in.
Talk now?
You don't want to get the bear's opinion about Taylor Elgersma because he hates the Packers, I'm sure. All bears do.
There we go.
Ding, ding, ding. It's a bear market for Taylor Elgersma, I would say, in terms of him making the roster, fellas. Like, no joke. I'm serious. Like, people out here, some of the comments I've seen on social media, are like, Taylor Elgersma doesn't even deserve a practice roster spot. I'm like, are we watching the same football games? Like, he has been the Packers' best quarterback in the preseason. I know Jordan Love, you know, got this injury on his own throwing hand, and he's had surgery now, and he hasn't played. I'm not saying he's better than Jordan Love, but he's looked better than Malik Willis and Sean Clifford for sure. And the playing time to me, fellas, says a lot. They're like, all right, kid, you're going to go on the road in Indianapolis, where it's usually pretty loud there in that dome. I know it's preseason, and we're going to see what you got for well over a quarter. Kid leads three scoring drives. Looks really good, driving the ball into some tight windows, throwing with anticipation. And arguably, most importantly, Matt LaFleur says post-game, like, yeah, there's a lot to like there. But I think he balanced it out nicely by saying, you know, there's still a lot to learn, which is ultimately true. But this situation with Taylor Elgersma potentially making the Packers 53-man active roster as the third QB or going on the practice squad has nothing to do with any other Canadian quarterback that's been down there before. Each situation individually is much different. Taylor Elgersma and his size should help him based on the people that I've talked to, his arm strength and all the rest. And the fact that he didn't go to the CFL and then come to the NFL, I think as much as people don't want to hear it, actually helps him. From a Packers standpoint, it's like, oh, we discovered this guy. We did our homework. We brought him in for a top 30. He's been here all offseason leading into training camp, and he continues to stack bricks. He continues to grow and lay a foundation there. He is looking very comfortable, does not look out of place, and it looks better than Sean Clifford. Like, if I'm the Packers right now watching the tape, I'm going, Sean Clifford has either plateaued or gotten worse in the offense that he's been in for multiple seasons now. And Taylor Elgersma looks like he's a dude out here firing rockets around the field, okay? To me, it's not even close right now. Taylor Elgersma looks better. I realize that's not how the politics go in the NFL. But, man, he seems like, at this point, fellas, I hate saying stuff like this, but I feel like it's true, like a shoe-in to at least be on the practice squad. How can you not keep this kid around?
You have to give Elgersma credit for making the most of the situation. And I've been skeptical about where this is headed. And I think anytime a youth sports player gets a shot in the NFL as an undrafted player, you have to have a healthy dose of skepticism. It's just the politics, right? It's how these things work. That said, him getting into the game as the second QB, like getting in way ahead of Sean Clifford, is the first real tangible sign that I've seen for meaningful optimism here, where it's like, okay, that's not by accident, right? The only, and by the way, Sean Clifford, for those who don't know, was a fifth round pick in the 2023 NFL draft out of Penn State, a collegiate career spent exclusively with the Nittany Lions. Not a top prospect, but like a good NFL prospect, right? He got picked in the fifth round, has spent the last 2 years in Green Bay. If you, as Mike LaFleur, you're setting your plan for this game as the head coach of the Packers. Matt LaFleur. You're saying, okay, if Taylor's the second quarterback in the game and we're going to give him like a quarter and a half of action, that to me is a message you're sending to Sean Clifford, which is like, you just got passed on the depth chart because there's no other explanation for Sean Clifford not getting into this game until the fourth quarter. So that's the first tangible sign I've seen for real optimism. Obviously, Elgersma playing well helps, but to me, this is the first time we've seen, wow, okay, this is a real sign. And it's not just a BS quote after practice, which coaches unfortunately give all the time. This is a real tangible thing. Going into this game, the Packers said, how do we want to allocate our snaps at quarterback? And whether it was LaFleur, whether it was the OC or whoever, they said, let's let the kid get in second and let's give him a ton of snaps, right? We don't need to see much of Clifford. We want to see lots of Taylor. So that is a big plus, I think, for the London, Ontario native.
Yeah, even more so than the order they went in, I think it's the timing, right? Because if Elgersma had gone in for two drives and then Clifford takes over, I think you say, okay, does it really matter which order they played? But in this circumstance, after playing literally just 3 minutes in the first preseason game, they put him in with 5 minutes remaining in the second quarter, gave him all that run, brought him out, let him play the entirety of the third quarter, and then into the fourth quarter, right? They gave him three separate drives, and all of them ended up in points. That matters. That sort of investment in time matters in an evaluation period. And I think the difference that people need to understand between Taylor's situation and something like Nathan Rourke, where Rourke also had strong play in the preseason and didn't necessarily get the love from the NFL that we were all hoping for, is that you don't bring in a player like Taylor from a U Sports school at that specific position unless you have a plan to develop him, right? You don't expect that guy to be ready right now. Whereas I think Nathan, who came from an NCAA program and had played professionally before, you're expecting him to be not a finished product, but a ready-made product. Taylor can have some of the mistakes and can take some risks with the football because the understanding from everyone through the pre-draft process is this a guy who's not ready right now, but who has all the tools. And all he needs is to be around NFL caliber coaching and inter-American system, and he's going to learn. I think what we've seen from the Packers is that they're leaning into that. He's jumped over Sean Clifford, and they're willing to make that investment.
I just hope that decision actually gets made. because too many times NFL politics come into play, and the fact that Sean Clifford has been around or he's liked in the room by Jordan Love, and they don't want to have that competition in there, or some kid from Canada that, you know, Brian Gutekunst and Matt LaFleur might be looked at weirdly from the American media and be like, really, you're keeping this Canadian kid over a kid from Penn State? It's like, yeah, he's actually better. Like, watch the games. Open up your eyeballs in the preseason for once. I hope it actually happens. Not because he deserves it, but because Taylor Elgersma has earned it. He's clearly gone in there, learned the playbook, looks comfortable in the pocket. Like, there was some junk on Twitter about people talking about he's looking shaky in the pocket. I'm like, again, are we watching the same football game? Just because he's from Canada, A, doesn't mean that he can't play quarterback at a high level. Do the Americans, do we need to refer them to the latest flag football game that happened? When Canada put it on you? Like, I'm sick of this BS, man. Like, it's mostly the American comments that I've seen that's like, some of them, give them credit, they're like, Taylor Elgersma laser show, which is what it appears to be he's putting on. But then some of them are like, yeah, he doesn't even deserve a practice roster spot. I'm like, you guys are crazy. I don't care where Sean Clifford played, even though it was Penn State. Doesn't matter. I don't care if he was draft pick in 2023 in the fifth round by the team. Through the first two preseason games, Taylor Elgersma has crushed this kid. It's not even close. Let's see what happens.
In fairness, the most recent flag football result was the United States beating Canada in women's flag at the World Games. So they've got that one over on us.
Fair.
It's now time for JC's Random Neglister, everyone's favorite new podcast segment. And I hear, Dunk, and you can confirm or deny this, that the Saskatchewan Roughriders might be in the market in the near future for a kicker. Well, they've got one on the neg list, so I thought I'd highlight him today. It's Alex Hale out of Oklahoma State. He's an Australian. He went unselected, actually, in the 2024 CFL Global Draft, but signed with the Green Bay Packers, who we were just talking about, and stuck around all of last season on the practice roster as their international player pathway program player. Apparently, they were fairly high on him as a developmental kicker, but he got released on July 21st because he suffered some sort of freak eye injury that was going to knock him out for a couple of weeks, and they needed to find somebody who was ready to kick right away. The Riders added him on July 22nd, clearly believing that a blind kicker is better than what they currently have on the roster. Hale's college resume isn't, you know, the most impressive. He suffered a couple of ACL injuries at Oklahoma State. It's only 79.6% for his career with a long of 53, but he was a two-time Lou Groza semifinalist and a second-team All-Big 12 selection as a senior. If the Riders were to bring him in and make him the kicker, it would require them to do a little bit of ratio juggling because one of the dumber rules in the CFL right now is you can't have three global players on the roster. They currently have a punter in Joe Couch and Habakkuk Baldonado, who is a key part of that defensive line rotation. One of those guys would have to come off the roster if you wanted to insert Alex Hale as the kicker. But Hodge, I know you put out on Twitter that you think the Riders should be trading for Liram Hirilahu down the stretch. Well, let me pose an alternative scenario. You sign Alex Hale, you make him your second global as the kicker, and instead of trading for Liram Hirilahu, you trade for the rights to Jake Julian from the Edmonton Elks, who no longer need him. You upgrade your kicker position, you upgrade your punter position. I think that's a scenario worth considering.
Or you get Liram Hirilahu because he's done anything at the professional level.
Yeah. I don't know that just the Argos are going to trade him, though.
The Argos are not going to the playoffs at this rate. So by the time the CFL trade deadline rolls around, the Argos could have been out of it for a while. So that's why I threw that out there. It's happened before that a team with a struggling kicker has brought in, flown in. Like, that's really one of few positions in football where you can take a flyer on a guy and he can come in and just do the job, right? Bringing in a middle linebacker at the trade deadline typically doesn't make any sense because you need a guy who's been in the system, knows everybody, everybody knows him, right? Kicker is one of very few positions. You can fly somebody in on a Thursday. They could play on a Friday. Yeah, there's some, you know, little details with the snap, the hold, all that stuff. But like, Liram Hierla, who has been there, he's done that. He's won multiple Grey Cups. That's why I put that out there.
You know Hodges, what I like the most is that you guys actually propose solutions. Fellas, this is too good to leave out, okay? You actually propose solutions because on the 620 CKRM postgame show, we had a caller who said one of the wildest things that I've heard in recent memory, okay? First, he said that his dead dog could be a better kicker than Brett Lawther. I don't know how that's possible at all. Then he said that the Riders should cut Brett Lawther and sign Justin Tucker. I'm like, okay, bro, that's not going to happen. He's made over $50 million in the NFL, plus he's facing possible discipline. So he ain't never coming up here. Then I said to him, what's your way to go with the kicker situation then? Who would you bring in? Dead silence on the phone line. So Hale makes some sense because he's on the neg list. Trading for Liram Hierolahu would make some sense. He's won a Grey Cup, made big clutch kicks. I think Brett Lawther could potentially get it together down the stretch, if my math is right, or dare I say the CFL stats are right. He made 22 in a row to end the regular season last year after having a rough game, actually on this very date, August 17th, against the Montreal Alouettes, where he missed four kicks, misses three in that game against the Ticats. So when fans come at us with this stuff, like, give us some tangible ideas, right? Real stuff. That's why I really liked Hodge's take about at least looking into a trade for Hierolahu.
There's also Michael Domagala, who's a free agent, went 8 of 9 with the Red Blacks in 2023. Like, yeah, he hasn't been around for a while, but there was a time where Brett Lawther hadn't kicked in a couple of years and the Riders took a flyer on him. And like 10 years later, he's still there. He's had a great career. So there's Boris a Canadian Beattie's on the street
there
too, right now.
Like there's Boris guys Beattie, out there.
Absolutely. Like there are guys. So I'm not saying you have to do a trade, but my point was that right now the Riders are a Grey Cup team except for one position. And yeah, on the one hand, we've seen Brett Lawther get it together before. Full credit to him. On the other hand, if the Riders get to the West Final, let's say as a 15-3 team, and they lose because Brett Lawther misses a bunch of kicks, there's a lot of people in that organization who are going to hide in their houses for the next 6 months because they don't want to be seen at the grocery store by fans who are going, what the heck did you guys, you could have traded for, right? That's what I'm saying. And I'm not saying that would happen, but there is a non-zero percent chance.
If that happens, there's going to be some manure involved.
Yeah.
There will be manure on multiple doorsteps. Exactly. So
you better stay in the house because stepping outside isn't safe for your shoes.
Might step into cow pie.
They might step on the bear pie from the bear outside JC's cabin. Go to Guelph for some turtle pie. My goodness. Now time for Hodges' heritage moment. Sad one. On this day in 2020, the CFL officially announced the cancellation of the season after the federal government refused to provide the league with a $30 million interest-free loan. It marked the first time the Grey Cup would not be awarded since 1919. I'm just going to say, boys, I could not be more thrilled to be here talking football every week and not have to worry about this junk.
This makes me think of that time Randy Ambrosi went to the government and asked for up to $150 million, up to being the keywords, without a plan.
Speaking of people who don't have a solution to a problem. Right?
Oh my.
But oh my. Hodge, you brought it up, bro.
I did.
You know what you were getting yourself into?
Yeah. It's a historic date. You can't not say it. It's August 17th. That's the date.
And for the record, I think as sad as it was for football fans in general and for the world, it was a date that's important for Three Down Nation because our ability to grind through that season where there was no coverage and provide something regarding the CFL, I think shaped us into what we are today. So I don't want to get all pat yourself on the back about it, but I think that is a turning point in the history of myself as somebody covering the CFL and of this website, that when the league shut down, we didn't. And I think that's why people still turn to us today.
Thank you, Chase Claypool. But JC, you did some wonderful work with your NCAA coverage that year. And I think that year you rolled out your top 10 feuds in CFL history. Is that right?
I believe that was that year. Yeah. That was a lot of work.
There was
awesome, though.
Yeah, and that content was genuinely awesome. I would encourage anybody who hasn't read them, please Google Three Down Nation Top 10 Feuds. It's an amazing series JC wrote. Frankly, it should be released as a book. But I will say we also, that year, the minimum standard for what would qualify as content was on the floor because what else was there to do? So yeah, we wrote some stuff that was genuinely great. We wrote some stuff that was, we just really need this to fill out Thursday and then tomorrow we'll worry about Friday. But we're here and everyone else is here and we're thrilled for that.
I believe my favorite was one.
Jameson Crowder, is that what you're going to say, JC?
No, I've got a different one.
Okay, I was going to say Jameson Crowder wore a Winnipeg Jets jersey randomly at a New York Jets press conference.
Gus Frerotte was on the Sports Cage, and they asked him about the CFL, and his exact quote was, "It's football." Like, I had to put anything in the headline.
My favorite I think it was a primetime game, but David Onyemata, then playing for the New Orleans Saints, now, of course, with the Falcons, excellent, excellent CFL career, or excellent NFL career, pardon me, just sacked somebody. And it was like, okay, this can be an article. David Onyemata sacks. It was whatever. It was like an aging Cam Newton or somebody. It was like, yeah, okay, it's content. We just got to get to tomorrow. Let's do it.
CanCon, baby. It's that Canadian content.
CanCon. Well, technically Nigerian content. I don't know if Onyemata actually has his Canadian citizenship or not, but
true.
He played U Sports, so it counts. It meets the standard. It counts.
For the CFL, at least. 3 minute drill, boys. The Winnipeg Blue Bombers have signed cornerback Demario Houston. Did that move surprise you?
It did, not for football reasons. Houston has proven he's a talented corner, and obviously Winnipeg has been absolutely smashed at that position with injury. Terrell Bonds out for the year, Jamal Parker hurt. But I was surprised because Houston was charged with domestic violence late last year. That was ultimately why he was cut by the Stampeders. He has since had those charges dropped, and it is expected that the charge will be expunged from his record. But he was still the subject of accusations from his wife, and the Bombers generally have steered clear of players like this in the past. So it speaks to their desperation that they're willing to bring in a guy knowing they're going to get flack for this move. The Calgary Stampeders have signed former NFL defensive back Brady Breeze. Is that the best name you've heard in a while?
Well, it's up there. I don't think it's the best name because Tiger Shanks exists, but Brady Breeze is a damn good football name, and I'm intrigued to see what he can do in Calgary because this is a guy who was a Rose Bowl defensive MVP and a hell of a special teams player at Oregon. That's really what got him drafted in the sixth round of the NFL draft. I think he could make an impact on their roster in some capacity. The BC Lions will retire number 56 this fall in honor of legendary linebacker Solomon Elamimian. Is he worthy of that honor?
Hell yes. This is an easy one. Probably arguably could have been done earlier, but I like that Amar Doman and the BC Lions are getting around to it with Solomon Elamimian. Probably one of the greatest franchise players in franchise history, if not, I was going to say the greatest, but he's up there. What do you think, JC?
I wouldn't say he's the greatest, but he's probably top 10.
The Montreal Catabins have hired longtime CFL defensive lineman David Menard as their new defensive line coach. Is that a good move?
Absolutely. Menard had a very good CFL career, despite being a little undersized, spent a ton of time getting after the passer, and this is his alma mater. So obviously he's a great fit. I know he's done training in that local community in Montreal. Coaching is a natural fit for him. Deion Sanders was rocking a Calgary Stampeders hat at practice at the University of Colorado. Why was Coach Prime wearing CFL gear?
Well, plug your ears, Hodge, because the CFL's global program has finally paid off in terms of marketing. It was Australian punter Mark Vassett, who's currently on the Stampeders practice squad, heading back to his old alma mater at Colorado and giving his coach some Stamps gear that led to this amazing photo opportunity. Drew Brees told the Dan Patrick Show that Doug Flutie was, quote, Patrick Mahomes before Patrick Mahomes, end quote. Is that a valid assessment?
Yeah, Drew Brees out here preaching, man. You know, the more I thought about it, I'm like, Drew Brees, damn, he is right. You think about the stuff that Doug Flutie was doing. I remember him with Toronto Argonauts and then San Diego Chargers, which is where Breeze and him were teammates, and the Buffalo Bills. Like, Flutie was doing some electric stuff. You could go back to his days at Boston College when he won a Heisman. He was in the USFL, I believe. Like, Breeze talked about how he played in all these leagues, but you know, I think he's right. Mahomes is arguably taking it to another level just with, you know, training and the fitness and all the stuff that's available to these athletes now. But Drew Breeze, man, you got a valid point. You have an open invitation, Mr. Breeze, if you ever wanted to come on the Three Down Nation podcast, talk about Doug Flutie or anything else CFL related, because we know he played with a coach in Sean Payton. They won a Super Bowl together in New Orleans, who has a lot of respect for the CFL. The University of Virginia unveiled a rebrand of their logos for the Cougars and Rams. What do you think of the new emblems?
I really like the logo. I'm just weirded out by the color scheme. Like, they've been the green and gold forever, and they're still marketing themselves as the green and gold, but they've done exactly what the Elks did and also what the Ticats did, which is they switched to yellow and are still calling it gold. They're green and yellow. They're not green and gold. Don't show me yellow and tell me it's gold. It looks very good, but they're not green and gold. This is green and yellow. I don't know why they made the switch. Gold looked perfectly nice, but the logo's good. PETA Vice President Philip Schein wrote a letter to CFL Commissioner Stuart Johnston calling on the league to end the use of leather footballs. What did you make of that?
Well, congratulations, guys. PETA's stunt worked because it got all the reaction that they were hoping for. This is what that organization does, right? They make sort of outlandish statements in order to generate publicity for their cause. In this case, the CFL, and by extension, the NFL as well, because both leagues were involved in this particular criticism when it came to the use of leather in football, was the target, and fans reacted exactly how they wanted them to, started a conversation about this subject. So, mission accomplished by PETA.
On a somber note, Kathy Smith, Craig Smith's wife, posted publicly a couple days ago that Craig has been moved to hospice. Craig, a very long-time CFL scout, personnel guy, and one of the best guys you could ever meet. He has been very public about his battle with cancer over the last number of years. JC and I got to see Craig at the CFL Combine in Regina, where he lives, and he was unbelievably happy to see everybody, and I think everybody was just as happy to see Craig, all the different people from all the teams taking pictures together. So we wanted to wish Craig, Kathy, and of course all their family and friends all the power and strength, and through a very tough time, obviously, with Craig going to hospice. Craig is as good a people as you could meet, and so we wanted to wish them well today and wish them strength and courage through the next while. For Justin Dunk and JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. We thank you, as always, for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. We would like to invite you to check out our picks this week, because I went 4-0 last week. I'm going to talk about it like 17 times on our pick show on Wednesday. Chopping it up with JC. We'll see you for a full episode of this podcast again next week.
I sold my car on Carvana last night.
Well, that's cool.
No, you don't understand. It went perfectly. Real offer, down to the penny. They're picking it up tomorrow. Nothing went wrong.
So, what's the problem?
That is the problem. Nothing in my life goes as smoothly. I'm waiting for the catch.
Maybe there's no catch.
That's exactly what a catch would want me to think.
Wow, you need to relax.
I need to knock on wood. Do we have wood? Is this table wood?
I think it's laminate.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's close enough.
Car selling without a catch. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.